Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace. Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
2, 1, 0, and go.
Oh, you've got an atomic clock in there. I forget.
I do. It's very fancy.
Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdal. Welcome back to me, also to you, to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
You're back. Thank goodness. I know we were all worried. I'm Molly Wood. Thanks for joining us. Kai is back from knocking on heaven's door, as my brother likes to say whenever he's sick. It is. What do you want? And luckily, we don't have to do that much work today because you have asked us all the good questions.
That's right.
What do you want to know? Wednesday is, of course, the show where you ask the questions, and we, and by we, I mean producers, and then whatever happens to be in our brains left over, supply the answers.
That's right. So we start with a question today about Florida's new social media law. Lots of press on that one the last, like, weekish or so. Alex in Pennsylvania says this: what is next for social media companies in Florida after the bill that was signed into law? Are Facebook and Twitter looking for amusement parks to buy now, or that's a little inside joke, or will Florida just be a social media wasteland? Ms. Wood, over to you.
Yeah, so if you didn't see all the press on this, Florida just signed into effect this new law that would fine tech companies for banning political candidates up to $250,000 a day if they permanently bar political candidates. It would also make it illegal to prevent some news outlets from posting to their platforms in response to the contents of their stories, aka if you write something that is abjectly disinformation or false, but you are considered a news outlet in the eyes of presumably the Florida legislature, then Facebook can't ban you. I mean, what's going to happen? Nothing. I'm just going to go ahead and quote from Michael Frumkin, a law professor at the University of Miami, who was quoted in Wired as saying, quote, "This is so obviously unconstitutional, you wouldn't even put it on an exam." Like, this is not...
That's a good one. I like that one.
What's fascinating is that there's been all this conversation about big tech companies censoring politicians or censoring, you know, far-right news outlets that write things that are not true. Censorship, I'm going to remind you again, is a tool of governments. Only governments actually have the power to censor speech. Companies do what they want because they're companies and they operate the entire stack and they can decide what goes there and what isn't. And on top of that, there is the well-discussed law, Section 230, which holds online platforms immune from liability over their content moderation decisions and specifically preempts states from making laws that override Section 230. So I almost feel like we actually need to stop calling the Florida law a law and call it like an influencer post. It's just a public relations stunt to indicate a certain kind of fealty.
That's exactly right. It's a demonstration of fealty. It's pandering to Donald Trump and that section of the Republican Party who follows the former president and is annoyed and PO'd and what have you about him being deplatformed from Twitter and so far anyway, Facebook. I think that's exactly right. Two things. One, the whole, you know, theme park, entertainment park thing is that there's a special clause in this law that it specifically exempts basically the Walt Disney Company. It says if you own a theme park of greater than 25 acres, this law doesn't apply to you. And so that's like Universal and Disney, and that's it. And then the other thing is, it boggles the mind that this is where things sit, that something so plainly just not grounded in any kind of constitutional reality passes and gets signed. I don't get it.
I mean, this is contra the First Amendment, unquestionably. You can't tell companies what they can do with their business and what, you know, speech they are. You cannot force them to allow speech. And this may be, you know, the opening salvo in a long battle against and over Section 230. And there have been lots of conversations about that. And people want to reform it on both sides of the aisle. We should not ignore the fact that what is essentially being proposed by this particular wing of the Republican Party, this specific kind of effort, is more disinformation.
Yeah.
Like what this is saying is, you know, Donald Trump should be allowed to foment an insurrection online. Stories that are patently false and do nothing but sow division within this country at whomever's behest should be allowed without interference because we like them. This is a pro-disinformation platform. And considering where we are in terms of information in this country, I think we need to like take that seriously as a push. But yes, to answer the very simple answer to what is going to happen with social media companies, they are not going to change a thing because they've already called their lawyers and they're expecting this, even though it is a waste of taxpayer money in Florida and, you know, Facebook and Twitter's money in terms of paying their lawyers. It is my firm belief that this is going to go away.
Yeah. Totally agree.
All right. Bill in New York wants to know, I can't believe we're already talking about this. Huh. This time of year, that's many crazy. Businesses are already placing orders from suppliers for the Christmas shopping season. Whew. With the chip shortage only likely to get worse in the short term, writes Bill, how might this affect this year's holiday shopping season?
Well, badly, Bill. And I think you have to define chip shortage in the short term as like 18 months to 2 years. We've talked about it here on this podcast. We've talked about it on Marketplace. It's going to be around for a good long while. And look, if you've got a gaming console, if you're doing smart speakers, you got a streaming device, all of those take at least one, probably a dozen, maybe two transistors, semiconductors, take your pick. Roku said, and this was in a letter to investors, thank you, Marissa Cabrera, here's what they said. We expect supply chain constraints to persist for the rest of the year and costs in components and logistics to correspondingly increase as the year progresses. So, not only are you going to have to wait longer to get your stuff, it is going to cost you more, right? That's just, it's supply, demand, and the reality of pent-up demand. I don't know what to tell you other than buckle up.
And it's going to be a long slog. Like, to be clear, long slog. I think Roku and Sonos both said they expect this disruption to last a year, maybe two. Ford said it was going to have to cut production as much as 50%. And that, you know, I mean, yes, these companies are scrambling to try to get some manufacturing, to diversify the manufacturing away from essentially this one Taiwanese foundry that, you know, that produces most of the chips for the entire industry. But it is not going to be, you're going to be wanting to look for, which, look, there's an argument to be made that, you know, not buying a bunch more disposable electronics for the holiday season is like a net good for.
It's not a terrible thing.
The planet, you know, you could buy like. Books or experiences or something, but there aren't going to be like laptop deals. If you're looking to order something like that, order now. Be like those suppliers. Order now.
Yeah, order now and cross your fingers, honestly.
Yep.
You know?
Totally.
All right, next. Tag team voice memo. We love those. Go.
Yes! Yo, Guy and Molly, this is Josh.
Yo!
And Jen from Anchorage, Alaska. And we've noticed over the last year of crazy pandemic life, that cash money is not something that we ever use anymore.
We get paid electronically. Our retirement contributions are electronically deducted. We pay our bills electronically.
Our Amazon, Uber, DoorDash bills are all settled digitally. We trade the same $100 back and forth with our friends through Venmo. It seems like all of our money is just a bunch of ones and zeros.
So the question is, don't we have a digital currency now? How is our life different from a digital yuan?
Thank you for making us smart on this and helping to keep us sane throughout this pandemic. We are high school teachers, and we just want to echo everything that Heather said about hybrid teaching. Your show has been one of the things that we look forward to every day.
Aw.
Well, that's nice. And that was a cool voice memo.
I feel like we've like pioneered a whole new, you know, content model with the with the tag team voice memo. It's delightful.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. We're looking for venture funding, by the way. Okay. So, yes, it's digital, but at the root is a dollar bill, right? Yep. At the root of this whole thing is actual fiat currency, the actual hard currency. And so while you are moving stuff around and you're getting paid and Venmo and all of that stuff, and it's doing it digitally, the currency at the root of it is a hard piece of paper or a coin, right? If the Federal Reserve and others, Chinese most specifically among them, go to CBDC, Central Bank Digital Currency, right, then it's actually directly injecting digital currency from the Federal Reserve into the money supply. And that's a different deal. It's, I know it sounds like a distinction without a difference, but it's a significant change, right? And as we talked about with China, right, it will let, just for instance, the Chinese government track where your money is going. And so there's no, there's not going to be any such thing as paying cash and being undetected, right? That's going to go away if the idea of a digital currency takes hold in some authoritarian, totalitarian countries. Don't know what the Federal Reserve's got in mind, but, you know, there are people who are going to want to know where all the money's going, right? You can think of the Internal Revenue Service. But that's the deal, right? There's a central banking system. It's all paper money, and it eventually goes to paper money. Sorry, go ahead.
Right. Like what you have, exactly, what you guys have is, what we all have is digital record keeping. What is so interesting to me about the idea of a central bank controlled digital currency is that it cuts out a lot of banks. So right now there is still money, and there is still money in banks. And at some point, probably actual physical money goes from one bank to another just to make sure that, you know, the digital records are in fact accurate. That could potentially go away, which means a couple of things. For example, you know how, like, when you just try to transfer money from one account to another, it can take a day or a couple days or not happen over a weekend.
Yep.
That is how you know you don't have a digital currency, because you have all these, like, weird, you know, patchworks of banking systems, and money takes a long time to go places, which makes no sense. In this case, the central bank could really just be like, oh, digital currency, boom, it exists. You transfer money between accounts instantly because there isn't any back-end check that has to happen, or literal check that ever has to be written. And then on top of that, you have this kind of tracking ability built in. But banks make money when money moves around. And I suspect probably the biggest reason that the Fed is not rushing necessarily to create a digital currency in the United States, because in China, the government controls a bunch of those banks. Yeah. Here, the banks are like, no, thank you, please.
Yeah, although, as we talked about the other day, Jay Powell is moving in a big bad hurry now that the Chinese are sort of starting to get serious about digital currencies, right? Because Powell recognizes that he doesn't want to be second mover in this space, right? He wants to maintain the supremacy of the U.S. dollar, whether it's hard, you know, fiat currency, or whether it's a digital dollar. And you know, he's got an institutional incentive to move. And, of course, Jamie Dimon and all the big Wall Street banks are like, so it's a fight that he's going to have.
I mean, we are pretty slow on this, I will say. I went to this Money 2020 conference, which I'm now realizing must have been October 2019, and interviewed the head of the FDIC and was like, so what are we thinking about, you know, cryptocurrency or digital currency? And they were like, what? Yeah. No. I mean,
really?
Literally,
wow.
The Fed was like, what? No, until 2 months ago.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and we're gonna have to hurry up. And I assume that a big part of the reason that we have not been in a hurry is that banks were like, what? No. You don't
No.
All right. Finally, another voice memo, a question that we got from Scott in California.
Hey, Kai and Molly. My question is, what's so special about working 40 hours a week? As the pandemic has forced everyone to work remotely and companies are planning for our flexible workplace in the future, why are we still hanging on to a 40-hour work week and not looking to create more flexibility in this aspect of work? Quick backstory. My wife and I are expecting our third kid, and while I work 40 hours a week in an office, traditionally, my wife's job has always been remote and allowed her to work 30 hours a week on her own schedule, a perk of working for a small nonprofit. it's given her the flexibility she's needed to pursue a career and allowed us to raise a family at the same time, without having to offload our kids into daycare for the bulk of the week. Then recently, I learned one of my coworkers just quit her job after only a few weeks back from maternity leave because it was just too much to try and do both. If we truly want to create a flexible workplace that supports working moms and dads, how about rethinking our working hour strategies from more than just 40 or zero? Thanks for making us smart.
Well, yep.
Yes.
For real. Right? I mean, there is some background. There's a reason. It's, you know, it's not invented. The 5-day, 40-hour work week, thank you, Marissa Cabrera, became part of American labor law when Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938. That was limited to 40 hours, in fact. It originally, a key part of President Roosevelt's New Deal, limited the work week to 44 hours because it had been so much longer. It was later amended to 40. One expert apparently told Vox that 40 hours was based on the idea that the worker was a man and the worker had a woman who was doing the reproductive labor in the home full time. And honestly, when you put it in that context, yeah, isn't that gross? Yeah, that's, yeah. But when you put it in that context, it really actually, you start to think like, wow, okay, so nothing about the 40-hour work week makes sense in a world where both people in a home may work because... Yep. It is predicated on the idea that someone's at home to take care of kids and the house. Yeah. And I was walking around my house today, like just doing little errands and getting ready for the cleaning lady. And just like, I was like, I think I do 100,000 things in the house, just any given day, just pick a thing up and put it over here and move this and then do that. And then change the light bulb and make sure that spider's dead. And you know, like that, all of that was also supposed to happen at the same time as me being in an office 40 hours a week. And that just like is definitely hard to sustain.
Yeah.
Don't at me about the spider thing.
Oh, no, 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 no. You got to be.
We get big ones.
Wait, why not?
Somebody's going to email me and they're going to be like, spiders are great for the bugs in your house. No.
Kill them. Kill them dead.
You're my favorite.
Kill them dead. I'm solidly behind Molly Wood on this one. Are you kidding me? all right. Super, super quick, because we promised you 15 minutes of knowledge and then we get out of your hair. But we can't do the knowledge without all y'all. We are aiming for 4,000 marketplace investors as we wrap up the May fundraising drive midnight tomorrow. Still need 1,000 more to give in the next couple of days. Make me smart. Sorry, it's not make me smart. It's marketplace.org/givesmart. We've got Songtail Zine. We've got the Molly Wood Memorial Mason Jar mug. We've got a tote bag, too. Every donor makes a difference, so help us out if you could.
Yeah, and we know that you will. 1,000 people, that's like nothing. That's a moderately great make me smart day. We can do this. And thank you. Thanks in advance, everyone. Well, only one more day for us to for you to hear about it. Yep. Or you could wrap it up sooner, and then we'll be all done.
Maybe we don't have to do this
Boopity
tomorrow.
Boop. Speaking of Carlton all done, Thorpe, we are.
Yes.
We are all done.
There you go.
You can send us more mail if you want. Make me smart at marketplace.com.
Yes.
We'd love to have it.
Emails, voice memos, all that good stuff.
Do it up. Make Me Smart is produced, directed, and frequently researched by Marissa Cabrera. RK Green is our intern. Another new one. That's right. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and Make Me Smart explainers. I bet he did a lot of research today, actually.
Okay, this is terrible. The intern that we loved, who left us, what was his name?
Ethan Peretz.
Oh, God. All right, I forgot. I'm sorry. Look, I've been
Sudafed.
Sick.
It's the Sudafed. I blame,
it
you
is
know,
Sudafed.
This is a drugs thing. It's just drugs.
God. People are going
to
at me about
Ethan,
that.
Ethan, don't listen
Carlton
to
Thorpe
him.
Is in charge today. Ben Dalladay and Daniel Ramirez did our theme music. Donna Tam is the senior producer. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. Oh, my God. Ethan Peretz.
Every intern just
such
quit.
A bad person.
They don't care about
such
us
a
at
bad
all.
Person. Oh, my God.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.